It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. In the center of our service, in the center of our lives, let us make room for life's quieter sides. You may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here.
Now please join me in an attitude of prayer. Let us be honorable and courageous stewards of the lives of our soldiers. Let us match their willingness to go where we aim them by making sure that the cause is worthy of their lives and of our own highest ideals. They trust us with their very lives, and that is not a figure of speech. We ask them not to flinch in the face of possible death. Let us not flinch in the face of what may be uncomfortable truths. May we learn from our veterans that there is something noble, even sacred, about putting our lives in the service of honest and high ideals, no matter the risk. It is our duty as citizens to ensure that the ideals our armies are really serving are as high and noble as those our soldiers think they are serving. And the pursuit of that may require from all of us a quality of courage like that shown by our soldiers in their wars. May we find that courage and be reconnected with those highest ideals. Amen. This contentious sermon title was inspired by a remarkable soldier of 75 years ago. A Marine Corps general named Smedley Butler, he was one of only seven men ever to win the Medal of Honor twice, and he was one of only two ever to win it for two different occasions. The other five were awarded two Medals of Honor for the same occasion, when it was felt that their bravery exceeded even the inexceedable. After World War II, a ruling was made that the Medal of Honor could never again be awarded twice. So he will always be one of only two men in our history who received the Medal of Honor for bravery on two separate occasions. I've also read that in the 1930s, he was one of the most respected veterans by other soldiers, which was partly due to his courage both on and off the battlefield. And I want to talk about his courage off the battlefield a little bit this morning. On August 21st, 1931, General Butler stunned an audience at the American Legion Convention in Connecticut when he said, "I spent 33 years being a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street and the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer for capitalism. I helped purify Nicaragua for the International Banking House of Brown Brothers in 1909 to 1912. I helped make Mexico, and especially Tampico, safe for American oil interests in 1916. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for American sugar interests in 1916. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National Citibank boys to collect revenue in. I helped in the rape of half a dozen Central American republics for the benefit of Wall Street. In China in 1927, I helped see to it that Standard Oil went its way unmolested. I had a swell racket. I was rewarded with honors, medals, promotions. I might have given Al Capone a few hints. The best he could do was operate a racket in three cities. The Marines operated on three continents." Now, I'm a veteran of the Vietnam War, and I would never want to think of myself as a corporate mercenary. It's a disgusting idea. Our dangerous private army of Blackwater today has plenty of people who seem proud to be corporate mercenaries in Iraq. But I suspect that nearly all of our real soldiers would be appalled at the idea, as I would also be. Still, General Butler didn't hate soldiers, and he didn't hate America either. In a story we should all have learned in school, but didn't, he was approached in 1934 by a messenger from a consortium of wealthy men. He was offered a suitcase full of $1,000 bills as a down payment if he would assemble an army, take over the White House, and install himself as America's first fascist dictator. Instead, he went before Congress and told the story. That testimony was filmed, and I've watched part of the film. He was a genuine American hero. And yet, in spite of this public testimony from the most respected soldier of his day and a 2-time Medal of Honor winner, the group of wealthy corporate men were powerful enough that not even President Roosevelt could have them prosecuted. And they were influential enough that, as far as I know, the story has been kept out of history textbooks for all high school and almost all college courses to this day. So maybe there is something to what he said. A second person whose writing has both greatly irritated and persuaded me is John Perkins. I read his book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, 2 years ago, and it made me feel like I'd been a naive, sleeping child for decades. It also irritated me because I thought what he had done for 10 years was so slimy. He, too, talked about how our soldiers are routinely used as pawns of some of the most powerful corporate and political interests in a game of American empire, American imperialism, and how they are used against the high ideals for which our country supposedly stands. So on this Veterans Day, I want to take our soldiers seriously enough and our citizens seriously enough to explore this story of American empire, the role soldiers may have been used to play in it, and the role that we all play in it. The hope is that the truth can help make us more free, though I have no idea how in the real world to change a story that's been part of us for so long. And that was part of the surprise to me. Our country was begun by the Puritans, as many of us will remember from history, as a nation chosen by God with a manifest destiny to rule the world. That phrase, manifest destiny, goes back to the 1620s, and it's been embedded in our history ever since. Eventually, if you think about it, such a dream of manifest destiny or empire would require soldiers as the weapons and as the cost. As General Butler said, war is a racket in which the profits are counted in dollars and the losses are counted in lives. The Monroe Doctrine of 1823 was used to take manifest destiny several steps further. It was used to assert that we had special rights over all the hemisphere, including the right to use our soldiers to invade any nation in Central or South America that refused to back our economic demands. Now, those are usually referred to in code language as our vital interests. President Theodore Roosevelt invoked the Monroe Doctrine to justify U.S. intervention in the Dominican Republic, in Venezuela, and in stealing Panama from Colombia. A string of subsequent U.S. presidents relied on it to expand Washington's Pan-American activities through the end of World War II. And during the latter half of the 20th century, the U.S. used the communist threat to claim the right of invading countries all over the world, including Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, and Indonesia. The 20th century was also fueled by oil, as we still seem to be. And as our own oil fields began running out, we became dependent on Middle Eastern oil. But, and this seems to be a uniquely American trait, maybe it's a trait of all empire, since we needed oil, we believed, as we always have, that we had a right to it. This is not meant as a rhetorical overstatement and is certainly not meant as an indictment of only Republican presidents. This is bipartisan. And it was stated very dramatically by Democratic President Jimmy Carter in his 1980 State of the Union address, when he said, "Let our position be absolutely clear. An attempt by any outside force to gain control of the Persian Gulf region will be regarded as an assault on the vital interests of the United States, and such an assault will be repelled by any means necessary, including military force." Although he referred to outside force, the policy has equally applied to actors within the Middle East itself, as was seen in the Gulf War of 1991 and the Iraq invasion of 2003, and as it is playing out now in the crisis over Iran. These are insights from John Perkins. He's irritated me because he made me change my thinking about something I didn't want to change my thinking about. And that's always irritating. For me, he's the most important and readable author for understanding how our American empire works, how all empire works, what's going on behind the scenes, and the role our soldiers are assigned in the grand scheme. Perkins worked for a decade as one of a group of monumentally sleazy people known among themselves as economic hitmen. Here's what he says about them, and I want to quote from him at some length because some of his persuasiveness comes from his confessional style as well as his arrogance. "We are an elite group of men and women who use international financial organizations to create conditions that make other nations subservient to those who run our biggest corporations, our government, and our banks. Like our counterparts in the mafia, we provide favors to those whose cooperation we are buying. However, and this is a very big caveat, if we fail, an even more sinister breed steps in, ones we refer to as the jackals, the professional assassins. The jackals are always there, lurking in the shadows. When they emerge, heads of state are overthrown or die in violent accidents. And if by chance the jackals fail, as they failed in Panama, Afghanistan, and Iraq, then young American soldiers are sent in to kill and to die. We channeled funds from the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and their sister organizations into schemes that appeared to empower developing countries and to serve the poor, while primarily, however, benefiting a few wealthy people and getting the countries into a trap of debt from which they could not escape. We would identify a developing country that possessed resources our corporations coveted, such as oil, arrange a huge loan for that country, and then direct most of the money to our own engineering and construction companies like Halliburton and Bechtel, and a few collaborators in the developing countries who we would make rich in return for their selling out their own country. History seems to show that there is no shortage of such people. Infrastructure projects such as power plants, airports, and industrial parks sprang up in these countries, paid for by the loans from our country and built by our engineering firms. However, Those things seldom helped the poor, who were not connected to electrical grids, never used airports, and lacked the skills required for employment in industrial parks. At some point, we returned to the indebted country and demanded our pound of flesh. Cheap oil, votes on critical United Nations issues, or troops to support ours someplace in the world like Iraq. The loans were used mostly to enslave these countries, not to empower them. If they wouldn't bite at the bait of loans, the jackals, the assassins, were sent in to replace uncooperative leaders with cooperative ones. And as Perkins says, world leaders understand that whenever other measures fail, the military will step in, as it did in Panama, Afghanistan, and Iraq. The most dramatic instance of this before our two invasions of Iraq happened in Panama, a story that seems not to have been covered or understood very well. We had trained General Manuel Noriega at our School of the Americas in the methods of terror and violence, and so we saw him as an easy mark and an ally. But when he became president of Panama, he changed. He refused to bow to Reagan administration demands that the Panama Canal Treaty be renegotiated. The backstory of this is President Carter had signed a treaty with Panama in 1977, letting the Panama Canal Treaty revert, as it was originally intended to do, to complete Panamanian control after 1999. The Reagan administration and many of our corporations did not want that followed. They wanted that treaty nullified, and they wanted Panama to agree to renegotiate it so that the United States kept control of the Panama Canal. This is what Noriega refused to do. Instead, he negotiated with Japanese to see about rebuilding the canal with Japanese money. On December 20th, 1989, the first President Bush had our soldiers attack Panama with what was reported to be the largest airborne assault on a city since World War II. It was an unprovoked attack on a civilian population. Panama and her people posed absolutely no threat to the U.S. or any other country except the threat of long-term economic profit-taking. Politicians, governments, and press around the world denounced the U.S. unilateral action as a clear violation of international law. We even kidnapped the president of Panama and put him in an American jail as our only prisoner of war for frustrating our economic ambitions. This is beyond the reach of adjectives. Our soldiers were used in this invasion not to serve freedom or democracy, but simply to serve the economic interests that brought great profit to quite a small number of wealthy investors, which is one dimension of what an empire is about. Then came our first invasion of Iraq, also done under the first President Bush. Why Iraq? We know that it had nothing at all to do with 9/11. The lies used to get us into Iraq have all been exposed and don't need to be rehashed. We know that the current Bush administration had talked about wanting to invade Iraq since the first week they were in power in January of 2001. But the West has been trying to grab Iraq's oil since 1918. Contrary to common public opinion, Iraq is not simply about oil. It's also about water and geopolitics. Both the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, rivers mentioned in the Bible, flow through Iraq. So all the countries in that part of the world, Iraq controls the most important sources of increasingly critical water resources. During the 1980s, the importance of water, politically and economically, was becoming obvious to us. Also, Iraq is in a very strategic location. Think about this. It borders Iran, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria, and Turkey, and it has a coastline on the Persian Gulf. It is within easy missile striking distance of both Israel and Russia. Military strategists equate modern Iraq to the Hudson River Valley during the French and Indian War and the American Revolution. In the 18th century, the French, British, and Americans knew that whoever controlled the Hudson River Valley controlled the continent. Today, it is common knowledge that whoever controls Iraq holds the key to controlling the Middle East. That's why Iraq. By the late 1980s, it was apparent that Saddam Hussein was not buying in to our economic hitman scenario. This was a major frustration and a great embarrassment to the first Bush administration. Like Panama, Iraq contributed to George H.W. Bush's wimp image. Many of us remember that phrase and that issue from the news. As Bush searched for a way out, Saddam played into his hands in another story that seems to have been underreported. Saddam had asked U.S. Ambassador April Glaspie what the U.S. would think if he invaded Kuwait. April Glaspie told him, "We wouldn't care." He invaded Kuwait. Bush responded with a denunciation of Saddam for violating international law, even though it had been less than a year since Bush himself had staged the illegal and unilateral invasion of Panama. Some of this, you can't make this stuff up. And so it was no surprise when the president finally ordered an all-out military attack. After the attack, the economic hitmen and women tried to convince Saddam to accept a deal similar to the deal we had made with Saudi Arabia, but he refused. If he had complied like the Saudis, he would have received our guarantees of protection as well as more U.S.-supplied chemical plants and weapons. When it became obvious that he was entrenched in his independent ways, Washington sent in the jackals. Assassinations of men like Saddam usually have to involve collusion by their bodyguards. But Saddam understood jackals because he had been one for us. He had assassinated one of his predecessors for us. He knew how this game worked. So he screened his men rigorously. He also hired a lot of look-alike doubles. His bodyguards were never sure if they were protecting him or an actor, and they weren't willing to take a chance on being wrong. He was smart. The jackals failed. So in 1991, the first President Bush sent in the military. Now, at this point, the White House did not want to take Saddam out. He's our kind of dictator. He was a strong man who could control his people, act as a deterrent against Iran, and control the religious factions within Iraq, which we've never been able to manage. The Pentagon assumed that by destroying his army, they had chastised him, and now he would come around. The economic hitmen and women went back to work on him during the 90s. Bill Clinton imposed sanctions. This is bipartisan. Until Saddam agreed to U.S. terms of ownership of their oil. Clinton's sanctions, according to estimates from Amnesty International, killed over a million Iraqis, including more than half a million Iraqi children. Saddam would not give in, and he would not give control of Iraqi oil to American corporations in any way. Assassinations were attempted, and once more they failed. So in 2003, a second President Bush deployed the military. Saddam was deposed and executed. Now look how this story accounts for a whole host of data very differently than the stories we were fed in the news. This is the story that Perkins has told and many others have told too, and that has persuaded me. Perkins has three books out now, and I recommend them to anyone who wants to know about this. His second book was one in which he contacted 12 other people who had worked in this field, the economic hit people field, all over the world, and asked them each to write one chapter on their own field of expertise. Now, some of them weren't very good writers, so not all the chapters are fun to read, but it gives tremendous amount of detail on things like 4,000 deaths in Congo since 1996 so that we can get cheap coltan for our cell phones and laptops, on the BCCI scandals, on how debt is used to keep countries impoverished, and many other areas like this. Then he came out with his second book, the third in this series, this year, the book called The Secret History of the American Empire, which I think is even better than Confessions of an Economic Hitman. There's a lot of detail in these books. After we invaded Iraq and Halliburton, Bechtel, and other companies got billion-dollar unbid contracts, John Perkins finally realized this is the same game he had helped play for a decade because the same companies are getting the same contracts in the same ways. And finally, this man who for 10 years didn't seem to be bothered at all selling out countries for his personal gain, and he wasn't a bit bothered taking, as he admits, a $500,000 bribe not to write a book about it in the 1980s, finally decided it was time to write a book about it. He took the book to 26 publishers who turned him down and wouldn't touch it with a pole, finally found a small publishing house in San Francisco that took it on. The book became an almost immediate international bestseller, as his new book is also now. The game, at least potentially, always has the same three steps. First, we try to use heavy-handed persuasion to bring a country under our economic control. If that fails, we try to assassinate its leader. This has worked in many countries for us. And if that fails, we send in our soldiers. So this seems to be how our dream of manifest destiny works today, and how both assassins and our soldiers are used not just to make those who run a few U.S. corporations rich, that would be too easy and too neat and too clean, but also to give us the benefits that we call the American way of life. Part of the cost of that is that over 2 billion people in the world are now making less than $2 a day, and that's tied to the fact that we can live much higher than they do. This is not a picture that I like at all. It's not a picture I'd ever wanted, any more than I had ever wanted to think of war as a racket or soldiers as pawns. But so many other people are affected. Not just our soldiers, not just the innocent people all over the world, but the families of everyone else who's touched. So many people are affected. I don't think we have a moral choice. I think we owe it to them, to our soldiers, and to ourselves to consider this darker picture and to try to get informed about it. We're complicit in so many things we don't want to think about because it feels like it pollutes our life, and nobody likes that. I don't like it either. I want to be pure. But then I remember the 4,000 or so American soldiers who've already died in Iraq, the tens of thousands who've been wounded and are being ignored, and the estimated 2 million Iraqis we've killed since 1991 in our efforts to take their oil and to start taking control of the Middle East and through controlling the world's oil to dictate terms to the world. This sounds like a very bad movie script that our leaders are writing and in which our soldiers are being assigned key roles but not noble roles. John Perkins goes into many more details in other areas of what our American empire looks like to the rest of the world, and I'll revisit him in 2 weeks. But war and imperialism, no matter how awful, just aren't what life is mostly about and can't be what life is mostly about. I'm reminded of a quotation from the historian Will Durant, who many of you know wrote this 12 or 13 volume, 8 billion page history of everything in the world. And then after that was his whole career. And after that, he wrote a 100 page book summarizing the 12 volumes called Lessons of History. I thought, that's arrogant. I read that one. And then he was asked in an interview late in his life. He lived into his early 90s. He was asked in an interview late in his life if he could sum up that 100-page book in 5 minutes. And he said he did it in less than a minute this way. He said, "History is riverbanks with a river running by it. In the river is all the blood and the violence from all of the most vicious and dramatic acts of history. On the banks, people live their simple lives. They make love. They hope. They trust. They raise their children. They sing songs. They hold worship services. They make art. And they die in each other's arms. History, he said, is what happens on the banks. Historians are pessimists because they ignore the banks for the river. I think that's true. Life is mostly about its healthy parts, or we wouldn't be able to go on. We couldn't live standing in that damned river week after week after week. Next week, Dina and I will each share a Thanksgiving homily. And I'll share some very optimistic, hands-on, actual, real-world things you can do in a lot of different ways to help serve those who are still serving the high ideals that we care about. For now, thank you again for your service, veterans, and something more. I know that when you served, you believed, as I also did, that we really were serving high ideals and noble causes. Looking back all these years, it may be hard to believe, but I was in the Vietnam War, and I believed everything I was told. I bought it all. And most of us in the war did. Most soldiers do. It's the only way you can do it. We all believed we were serving high ideals and noble causes, which, if it came to it, were worth our lives. We believed it. That's what made our service memorable. And sometimes even sacred. Mine was. And I believe, as I think you do, that if we can find a way to convert our nation back to high and noble ideals, it can transform our nation's soul back to something noble, even sacred.